The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Okay, let's unpack this. We're diving into a topic that, well, it really inspires headlines. You see miracle cures, but also these really complex ethical debates. Stem cells.
It's definitely a field with a lot of noise around it.
Exactly. And for anyone trying to cut through that sensationalism, you know, to understand the genuine science, it can feel almost impenetrable.
It truly is a high-stakes area.
Yeah.
And our guide today really helps ground us. Jonathan Slack, he's a professor of biology at the University of Bath.
And his authority comes from a specific place, right? Developmental biology.
Yes, precisely. That's the science of how life, well, how it builds itself up from just a single cell. It's foundational.
That deep expertise feels crucial here because Slack doesn't just, you know, look at the shiny applications. He's analyzing the actual operating instructions of life.
Right. And he offers this rare, really balanced perspective.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get carried away with the hype, but he's not overly pessimistic either. He stays grounded in the science.
Which is what we need.
And Slack's core purpose, really, is to equip you, the listener, with the scientific literacy you need to evaluate all those claims you hear.
So to do that, we have to start right at the beginning, the fundamentals.
Yeah.
What actually makes a stem cell unique?
Okay. Slack defines it by two absolutely essential properties. Think of them like master controls for the cell.
Okay. Master controls, what's the first one?
First is self-renewal. This is the cell's capacity to divide, but potentially almost endlessly, and just create more copies of itself. It maintains the pool of stem cells.
Got it. Making more of itself. And the second?
The second key property is potency, or you might hear it called differentiation. This is the really interesting part. It's the ability to receive signals and then mature into specialized cell types.
Like a nerve cell or a blood cell or a muscle.
Exactly. Any of the specialized cells that make up our bodies. It's this ultimate cellular flexibility.
Okay, so those are the two defining features. Self-renewal and potency. But then you hear all these different types of stem cells mentioned. How do scientists categorize them? The terminology seems pretty important here.
Oh, it's absolutely critical. We use a taxonomy, a classification system, based entirely on that second property, the degree of potency. Think of it like a ladder
right.
of potential.
A ladder. Okay, what's at the top?
At the very top, you have totipotent cells. The classic example is the fertilized egg right after conception. These cells have total potential.
Total meaning.
Meaning they can form the entire organism, every cell type,
right.
plus all the supporting structures needed for development, like the placenta, everything.
Wow. The single cell that can build literally everything.
Precisely. Now, move one step down the ladder and you find pluripotent cells.
Ah, this is where embryonic stem cells, ESCs, come in, right? The ones that get talked about a lot.
Exactly. Pluripotent cells can still form any cell type in the body. Nerve, muscle, blood, skin, you name it. But, and this is crucial, they cannot form a whole viable organism on their own. They can't make the placenta, for instance.
That distinction is really important, I imagine, especially for the ethical discussions.
Vitally important. And then if we go further down the ladder, we get to the cells that are doing most of the work inside us right now.
They don't have that kind of become anything potential, do they?
No, they don't. Below pluripotent are the multipotent cells. This category includes most adult stem cells, or ASCs.
Adult stem cells. So found in adults, obviously.
Yes, and in children, too. They're much more restricted. They can typically only differentiate into a limited range of cell types, usually within one specific tissue or organ system.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Think about the stem cells in your bone marrow, the hematopoietic stem cells. They're multipotent. They can create all the different types of blood cells, red cells, white cells, platelets, but they can't suddenly decide to become, say, a brain cell.
Okay, so it's like ESCs are maybe like a general contractor who can build any part of the house, whereas an ASC is more like the specialized electrician or plumber focused on one system.
That's a pretty good analogy, actually, yes. And then right at the bottom, you technically have unipotent cells, which can only make one specific cell type, but they can still self-renew.
Okay, so this hierarchy, toti, pluri, multi, uni, is all about how much flexibility they have.
Exactly. And understanding this is key to understanding both the potential and the limitations of different stem cell therapies. But there's another crucial piece Slack emphasizes.
What's that?
It's not just the cell itself, it's the neighborhood it lives in. He calls it the stem cell niche.
The niche, like its local environment.
Precisely. It's a specialized microenvironment around the stem cell. It's full of other cells, structural molecules, and crucially, signaling molecules.
And these signals tell the stem cell what to do.
Exactly. The niche sends molecular cues that basically control the stem cell's fate, telling it whether to stay quiet, divide to make more stem cells, self-renew, or start differentiating into a specialized cell type.
Huh. So when we talk about therapies like injecting stem cells into damaged tissue,
yes,
it sounds like it's not just about getting the right cells in there.
Yeah.
If the environment, the niche, is damaged or sending the wrong signals.
You've hit on the core difficulty of regenerative medicine. That's the challenge. The stem cell itself might be perfectly healthy and potent, but its fate is dictated by that niche.
So if you inject stem cells into, say, a scarred heart after a heart attack.
Right. If the niche in that damaged heart tissue is full of signals saying, make scar tissue, the stem cells you inject might just, well, they might die, or they might just contribute to more scarring or differentiate incorrectly.
So understanding and maybe even controlling that niche, that specialized microenvironment, that's kind of the holy grail.
That's arguably the central challenge. Fixing the environment might be just as important, if not more so, than just adding new cells. It's incredibly complex.
Okay, that complexity really sets the stage. Now let's talk about the three sort of heavy hitters in stem cell history, the ones that really define the research field. Where should we start? Maybe with the ones that prove the concept actually works in practice?
Good idea. Let's start with adult stem cells, ASCs, specifically the hematopoietic stem cells, HSCs, we mentioned earlier, the ones in bone marrow.
The blood-forming ones.
Yes. These are kind of the unsung heroes. Work by scientists McCulloch and Tell back in the 1960s really established their existence and function. And this isn't just theoretical. This process is happening inside you constantly right now. Your HSCs are working away, replacing billions of your blood cells every single day.
Wow. And this is the basis for treatments we already use, isn't it?
Absolutely. Slack highlights bone marrow transplantation, or hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, as the oldest, most established, and arguably most successful stem cell therapy we have.
It's the proof of concept.
It is. It definitively shows that stem cell therapy can work incredibly well, saving lives even, when the science is thoroughly understood and the process is rigorously controlled. It treats leukemias, lymphomas, and other blood disorders.
Okay, so ASCs are the established workhorses, but then came the big explosion in research, right? With ESCs.
Right. The field truly ignited in 1998. That's when James Thompson and his team successfully isolated human embryonic stem cells, ESCs, from the inner cell mass of early-stage embryos called blastocysts.
And these are the pluripotent ones we talk about, the ones with that near-limitless potential to become any cell type?
Exactly. Their raw power was undeniable. Suddenly, the potential for regenerative medicine seemed immense. But as we touched on, deriving these ESCs involved, well, it involved the destruction of the human embryo.
And that kicked off the huge ethical debate that we still hear about.
It did. A major, major controversy that shaped the entire field. But interestingly, that ethical pressure, it actually ended up driving innovation in a really unexpected way.
Wow.
It pushed scientists to find alternatives, an ethically acceptable way to get pluripotent cells without involving embryos. And that led to what you rightly called a scientific earthquake.
Okay, the third heavy hitter then.
Induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPSCs. This was the groundbreaking discovery by Shinya Yamanaka in Japan, first in mice in 2006, and then in humans shortly after.
This still blows my mind. He found you could take a regular adult cell, like a skin cell.
Yep, a fully differentiated specialized cell.
And basically reprogram it, turn back the clock.
That's exactly it. He discovered that by introducing just four specific genes transcription factors, now famously known as the Yamanaka factors, into that adult cell, you could essentially hit a molecular rewind button.
And the cell reverts back to a state that's functionally equivalent to an embryonic stem cell, pluripotent.
Correct. It behaves like an ESC. It can self-renew and it can differentiate into all the different cell types of the body. It was revolutionary.
Why was it so revolutionary, apart from sidestepping the main ethical issue with ESCs?
Oh, well, that was huge, of course. But the other massive implication was the potential for personalized medicine.
How does that work?
Think about it. You could take a small skin sample from a patient who has a genetic disease, maybe Parkinson's or a specific heart condition.
All right.
Then you turn those skin cells into iPSCs. Now you have pluripotent stem cells that are genetically identical to that patient.
Yeah, their own cells.
Exactly. Then in the lab, you can differentiate those iPSCs into the specific cell type affected by the disease, say the dopamine producing neurons for Parkinson's.
So you can create the patient's diseased cells in a dish.
Precisely. You have a disease in a dish model, genetically matched to the individual. This allows researchers to study how the disease develops at a cellular level, test potential drugs directly on the patient's own cells, and maybe someday even develop cell therapies using the patient's own corrected cells.
That's incredible. Personalized disease modeling and potentially personalized therapies.
It opened up entirely new avenues.
Okay, so we have the established success of bone marrow transplants using ASCs, and then this huge potential unlocked by iPSCs alongside the ongoing research with ESCs. But let's bring in that reality check Slack emphasizes. Where do things actually stand with translating these newer potentials into real-world treatments?
Slack is very clear on this. The future promise is definitely bright, but the path is long and challenging.
It's not instant cures.
Far from it.
Yeah.
Researchers are making real progress in labs and early clinical trials. There's exciting work on using stem cell-derived cells to repair cardiac tissue after heart attacks, developing therapies for spinal cord injuries to restore some function, creating retinal cells to treat macular degeneration.
So the potential is being explored actively.
Very actively. But remember the niche. Getting those cells to integrate properly into the existing tissue, function correctly long-term, and crucially, not form tumors, that remains a massive hurdle.
Right. The complexity is immense. I think Slack's core message here is really important. He says something like, stem cells are not magic bullets.
But they are precision tools with unprecedented potential. Yes, that distinction is paramount.
Precision tools, not magic. Meaning it takes skill, understanding, and a lot of work to use them effectively.
Exactly. The journey from a promising result in a petri dish or a mouse model to a proven, safe, and effective therapy available to patients. That journey is typically measured in years, often decades, of rigorous clinical trials. Phase 1 for safety, phase 2 for efficacy, phase 3 for large-scale validation.
It's a slow, methodical process for a reason.
For safety and efficacy, yes.
Now, we've focused a lot on the potential for good, but there's a darker side to stem cell properties, isn't there? Something called the cancer stem cell hypothesis.
Yes, this is a really significant area of research with profound implications. It's deep irony, really.
How so?
The very properties that make stem cells so powerful for regeneration, that almost unlimited self-renewal capacity and the ability to spawn different cell types, might be hijacked by cancer.
So cancer cells are mimicking stem cells.
The hypothesis suggests that many tumors aren't just a uniform mass of identical cancer cells. Instead, they might be driven and sustained by a small, distinct population of cancer stem cells within the tumor.
And these cancer stem cells have those key stem cell traits.
That's the idea. They can self-renew, creating more cancer stem cells, and they can also differentiate to produce the bulk of the non-stem cancer cells that make up the tumor mass.
Why is that particularly bad news for treatment?
Because these cancer stem cells are often thought to be more resistant to standard therapies like chemotherapy and radiation, which typically target rapidly dividing cells.
So you might shrink the tumor by killing the bulk cells, but if the cancer stem cells survive,
they could potentially regrow the tumor later, leading to relapse. It suggests we might need treatments that specifically target these resilient cancer stem cells to achieve lasting cures. It's a major focus in oncology research.
Wow, it's the system's self-maintenance tools turned against itself. That's sobering. Okay, let's pivot back slightly to the ethics. You mentioned earlier that the controversy over ESCs actually spurred innovation, pushing towards iPSCs.
Yes, it's a fascinating example of how ethical considerations can directly influence the direction of scientific progress.
It wasn't just a roadblock?
Not entirely. While the ethical debate certainly created challenges and restrictions, it also acted as a powerful motivator. The intense desire to find ethically non-contentious sources of pluripotent cells forced scientists to think outside the box.
Away from just using embryos.
Right. It pushed them towards fundamentally harder scientific problems, like figuring out how to reprogram a mature cell. Yamanaka's work wasn't the easy path compared to using readily available ESCs at the time.
So the development of iPSCs wasn't just about solving an ethical dilemma.
No, it did much more than that. As we discussed, it opened up entirely new avenues of research, like that patient-specific disease modeling, which might not have emerged as quickly if the field had solely relied on ESCs. The ethical pressure inadvertently forced a creative leap.
That's a really powerful illustration of science and ethics interacting, driving each other forward. Okay, so bringing this all together, what are the really crucial practical takeaways for someone listening to this? trying to navigate the headlines and the hope surrounding stem cells.
This is where Slack offers some really vital guidance, particularly around critical thinking and regulation.
Because there's a lot of misinformation out there.
A huge amount. Slack issues a very serious warning about something called stem cell tourism.
What's that?
Because there's so much hype and hope, especially for debilitating diseases with few options, unregulated clinics have popped up around the world. They often exploit desperate patients and their families by offering unproven, often scientifically baseless and potentially dangerous stem cell treatments, usually for enormous sums of money, tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Wow. So how can we, or you the listener, distinguish between legitimate cutting-edge research which is happening and this kind of predatory fraud?
Slack empowers you to ask critical questions. The absolute key is rigorous, regulated clinical trials. Any legitimate therapy progressing towards clinical use must go through formal trial phases overseen by regulatory bodies like the FDA in the US or the EMA in Europe.
So always ask for the evidence.
Always ask. Is this treatment part of a registered clinical trial? Can you show me the published data from phase 1, phase 2, or phase 3 trials? If a clinic is making grand promises but can't provide evidence from rigorous peer-reviewed studies and regulatory oversight, be extremely skeptical.
If it sounds too good to be true.
It almost certainly is.
Yeah.
Rigorous regulation and critical evaluation of the evidence are your best defense against misinformation and potentially harmful, ineffective procedures.
That's such an important practical point. And looking at the bigger picture, this whole field really underscores something else too, doesn't it? The sheer complexity and collaboration needed in modern science.
Absolutely. You can see it clearly here. Moving stem cell science forward isn't just about biology anymore. It requires deep expertise in genetics, developmental biology, molecular signaling, bioengineering to create scaffolds or niches, sophisticated imaging, plus constant ethical reflection and robust regulatory frameworks. It's intensely interdisciplinary.
It really is. For me, thinking about Slack's work, what really stood out was that a dual nature, the staggering complexity, especially around controlling that stem cell niche, but also the genuinely transformative power of breakthroughs like iPSCs. It felt like a true scientific earthquake.
I agree. And perhaps the most valuable lesson from Slack's perspective is that these revolutionary scientific advances, the ones that really change paradigms, they require this blend of bold, imaginative vision like Yamanaka, daring to think you could reprogram a cell, combined with years, decades sometimes, of incredibly patient, meticulous, methodical work.
And built on that foundation of ethical consideration we discussed.
Exactly. Which leads us maybe to a final provocative thought to leave you with.
Go on.
Slack's work reminds us that we're fundamentally investigating the basic principles of life, development, and repair. Some animals, like salamanders, have incredible regenerative abilities. They can regrow entire limbs.
Right, something humans can't do.
Not currently, no. But if, as Slack's field explores, we can truly master the molecular signals, understand the niche controls that allow that salamander to orchestrate limb regrowth, what does that imply about our own human capacity for regeneration?
Hmm.
Could similar pathways be dormant within us, waiting to be reactivated?
Wow. That opens up huge possibilities.
It does, and it also raises profound future questions. What new ethical frameworks will we need when creating personalized tissues or even organoids? Mini organs grown in the lab from stem cells becomes routine. How will we navigate a future where regenerative medicine might fundamentally alter what it means to heal or even to age?
Really makes you think about where the science could ultimately take us.
Indeed. The potential is immense, but so are the responsibilities that come with it.
A fascinating and complex field. Thank you for unpacking that with us.
My pleasure. It's crucial science to understand.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.